haven't I?
Mr. Goldsworthy, real nine.
My God, he said. He was on that, was he? That was not the only thing that convinced me that Crabb had been on a clandestine mission below the Russian ships, of which I got ample further evidence later. It was what did not happen that was so telling. Crabb, despite his vast experience, was not the man to be chosen to test secret new equipment when serving specialists like my friend were so close at hand. But even if he had been, it would have broken all proper diving rules for him to be working alone without backup. And if he'd gone missing, then certainly Vernon would have been asked to bring search and rescue parties to the scene. The conclusion was inescapable. But could it be written at that stage? I thought not. Perhaps it was my years in naval intelligence taking over from the journalistic instincts to publish and be damned. Through my personal knowledge of the man, I dictated a brief life history and then communicated my personal convictions to the night news editor, John Young. Broadly, the newspapers accepted and embroidered the Admiralty's, quote, secret equipment tests in Stokes Bay, close quote, version of the event, until someone in Whitehall ordered the Portsmouth CID chief to remove from the Sallyport Hotel register the pages containing the names of Crabb and his companion. When that became known, the Stokes Bay accident story looked sillier than ever. The Crabb story went out of any sort of official control, and the tight-lipped attitude in Parliament did nothing to stem the worldwide speculation. The one thing the resident clerk's scanty information had achieved was to admit that he was on some business for the Admiralty when he was lost. He had, in naval slang, been taken on the slop jet, an expression used when a sailor signs for the custody of naval property. Too late now for any elaboration of the Stokes Bay fib to look convincing. Too late for confidential approach to editors not to probe into the background of the death. Too late to disown him as having been on some personal adventure for some other body. As the naval information officers were bombarded for demands for information, they refused to give. One senior officer said to me privately, maybe some bloody fool left a propaganda H-bomb lying around to be found. But with the newspapers who found it, wrapped it up and in a parcel and handed it over to the Russians. On the flood tide of publicity, the Daily Mail began serialising Marshall Pugh's book, originally to be called The Watch Below, about the missing frogman's life. That led to my receiving the only letter of rebuke ever addressed to me by editor Arthur Christensen. On May the 8th, he wrote, "Dear Frank, I wish I had known that you were once interested in writing the life story of Buster Crabb long before Marshall Pugh was put on the job. We could have spiked the Daily Mail's guns quite easily with your knowledge if you had let me know. And I know that you're as much concerned to spike the Daily Mail's guns as I am." I replied, "Dear Mr. Christensen, thank you for your letter. I hope you do not feel I've let you down. When Crabb helped me with certain technical details of the Gibraltar human torpedo series I wrote in 1948, he suggested that I should ghost a book on his experiences. But I felt that I could not commit myself to such a big task on top of my ordinary job, nor was I sure that I could get your permission. I refused, and therefore never actually gathered the immense amount of material which would have been necessary to compete with the current Daily Mail series. But having worked as an intelligence officer with Crabb in Gibraltar and Italy, I did know him well. When Bernard Hall telephoned me at home on my day off, I phoned back within half an hour, giving from memory a three-slip personal memoir of the man. From that point on, I considered it was on record with the office that I knew Buster Crabb. I'm sorry now that I didn't send a memo to you direct. The same night, after two calls to Portsmouth, I told John Young, for the information of Mr. Pickering, the night editor, that I was convinced that Crabbe was making an underwater reconnaissance of the Russian ships, though obviously I had not enough evidence to write it. Nor do I think it should have been written. We can, I submit, still spike the mail's guns by running the exclusive story I wrote about how 13 years ago Crabbe might have been at the center of an equally big diplomatic row if the War Cabinet had not turned down his plan to invade a Spanish harbor and sink an Italian ship, which was the basis for the human torpedo attacks, although we didn't in fact know that with any certainty until later. May I add, I wish I had seen the first letter in Express Post today before it was published. It's complete rubbish to talk about underwater fights between frogmen. Enemy frogmen can be killed at 100-yard range with small charges. Crabbe did great work which required a different quality of courage, that of the steel-nerved technician. That feature about the Altera incident was then fished out of the feature editor's tray and published. When I showed Willie Crumley, our official naval reporter, the exchange of letters, he said, "Forget it, Frank. Chris is kicking himself that he turned down the Marshall Pugh book, and he has to have a swipe at someone." It was at that stage it was decided the Express should publish a quickie book on the affair. The job was given to reporter John King and myself, John doing the on-the-spot inquiries in Portsmouth, while I went the rounds of the friends in London. Those friends had been given more than mere hints that he was up to something. He had talked of having a couple of days off to take a little dip and have a look at the Ruskies' bottoms. He was never a discreet man. When, as a staff officer intelligence at Leghorn, I circulated secret papers to him, I usually had to go in search of them because he was too casual about paperwork to return them. In Portsmouth, he sought out old friends and would have stayed at the Navy's favourite pub, the Keppel's Head, with the B&K Visit pressmen, if there had been a room to spare. Together, John and I built up a picture of the mysterious Mr. Smith, whose signature in the Sallyport Hotel register was the main reason for that panic station in removing the pages. He really was called Smith, Bernard S. Smith. I know that because he bought two coffee bar tables from Crabbe's employer and paid with a cheque for £4.18. But the bank returned the cheque because it was dated 1955 instead of 1956. Crabbe said, "Give it to me, I shall be seeing him when I go to Portsmouth." Both Mr. Smith and Crabbe had gone out before the Sallyport staff got up on the 19th of April. Crabbe never returned. Smith went back in the afternoon, paid both bills, and took away Crabbe's personal property. The cheque was not in the civilian suit which was handed to Crabbe's mother by a naval officer, but soon afterwards the bill was paid in cash by a woman who called at the shop, then succeeded in giving the slip to a reporter who tried to follow her. All this, and a great deal more, we assembled for the book as the government continued to stonewall parliamentary and press demand for an explanation. I was doing a final chapter on the political consequences of the event, was midway through quoting a Times leader demanding tighter control of, quote, adventurous spirits on the under-counter side of the services, when someone came from the editor's office and said, "Forget it, Frank, we're not going to do the book." I never finished the sentence. I stuck the draft into my drawer and took it with me into retirement 20 years later. I have no doubt that Lord Beaverbrook had decided not to prolong the political embarrassment of his friend Anthony Eden, then the Prime Minister. what is the truth about the crab affair? I have my own theory and claim no novelty for it. Crabb was an enthusiast. He loved the underwater work. He was a patriot and he hated communism. I think he persuaded some of the less responsible elements in British intelligence that there was something to be gained by inspection, by touch, not vision, of the Russian ships. If it had been a purely freelance adventure, the Admiralty would have been only too willing to disown him altogether. But I do not believe that any senior officer knew of anything of his intentions. He made his dive. At one of the official parties during the B&K visit, a Russian officer mentioned, almost casually, that a frogman had been seen near their ships. A senior British officer promptly assured him that that could not be so, and this was accepted. I believe there was a sighting, but only a fleeting glimpse, one with no time for a single observer to get confirmation. Now, this could provide an explanation for Crabb's death. He had not dived for over a year. He was 46, not particularly fit. He drank too much for that. His equipment was not of the best. He had no skilled attendant. So it could easily happen that he surfaced unintentionally and, desperate to escape detection, overreacted in submerging, got into difficulties and drowned. Years before, at Gibraltar, one of the Italian aces nearly drowned himself in just such a panic. There's one other point which has come to my knowledge recently, and that is that the sighting was supposed to be timed around 7:21 in the morning, long after daylight. And in that case, I believe it was not a living crab, but a dead man who might have just surfaced temporarily and then been carried away by the tide. 14 months later, a rubber-suited corpse, head and hands eaten away by marine animals, was found in Chichester Harbour in a position where currents could have carried crab from Portsmouth. I have no doubt that it was crab. And all the stories of him having been captured and turned by the Russians are rubbish and an insult to a brave, if misguided, patriot. The crab mythology seems to have built up over the years, and books have been written which I think had really no foundation in fact. At the very best, they were what reporters call think pieces, taking a few scattered uncertain facts and stringing them together to provide some exciting possibility.
So you don't think there's any truth in the speculation that Russian security people might have had an underwater struggle with him?
No, not for a moment, not for a moment. Well, they had some underwater, what you say?
Well, Chapman Pincher, I think, in one of his books suggests that there may have been an underwater compartment on the cruiser containing Russian frogmen to protect it from any espionage.
Just unreal to my mind.
Did you cover the Suez War of 1956?
Yes, well, I was in Jordan at the time when the crisis moved to explosive point there, and I got out on the last in Jordan, from Jordan, in the last United Nations convoy, went down to Beirut, and then asked permission to go back with my usual sort of assignment with the Navy. And on the 3rd of November, I flew into Cyprus in time to talk to the air crews who had dropped the British paratroops into the canal zone, and to spend a long, frustrating night listening to radio messages when a politically imposed ceasefire stopped the British advance just short of an airfield. Um, The fast mine layer Manxman, an old friend from Gibraltar days, took us to the submarine depot ship Tyne, which had moved into the still burning port side as a communications and accommodation ship. My memories of the next 5 days are of uncollected bodies lying half out of shut-up cars, burning buildings, the occasional crack of sniper fire, of masses of sunken shipping in the canal, and more angry and frustrated journalists than I ever met in my life. The invasion, which the politicians wanted to call a police action, had now become an uneasy ceasefire. So there was not much action to report, even if the communications worked, and mostly they didn't. Press messages were having to be sent, were to have been sent, by an £80,000 high-speed transmitter. But, so the story went, someone had dropped it on the beach and it never worked. So, though those of us on board the Tyne managed to get a few messages away, reporters attached to the army were having to send copy back by shuttle service planes to Cyprus, where likely as not it got snarled up in the censorship operating there. To add insult to injury, the reporters who'd been unable to get accreditation to the forces, now in Egypt, began coming over from Cyprus on day trips and flying back in time to steer their own copy through the censors. Some who had been in the invasion armada never even put a foot on land, and some of those in the bigger ships never saw port side even from the sea. And to cap it all, for the whole period of the port side operation, the eyes of the world were fixed on Hungary, where the popular uprising was finally quelled when 16 Russian divisions moved in on the day before the paratroop landings at port side. On board the Tyne, the Padre invited journalists to sit at the Brains Trust to discuss the situation with the chiefs and petty officers. I was invited to take part, but I refused, feeling, as I did, that we were all engaged in a monumental blunder. I thought it wrong to air those views to fighting men with a job to do. Fred Spark, the well-loved Chicago Daily News reporter, who had been such an entertaining companion in the Korean War, agreed to go. But as an American, he was in a vastly different position. After 5 days, I went back to Nicosia, transferring my accreditation to Keith Morfitt. Then on the 13th of November came, "Well done, please come home." The trip, which had begun with a 3:30 a.m. phone call 20 weeks before and had taken me to 5 different trouble spots, was over, and I was pretty late for my summer holidays. I was on holiday in Llandudno in 1958 when I read in the evening paper that if Iceland persisted in its intention to extend its fishery limits from 4 to 12 miles, the Royal Navy will be there to protect our trawlers from arrest. Now, this news had a strong smell of good sea air, and I went into the nearest phone box to ask the news editor to apply for me for a place for me in the senior ship. As time drew to the near to the critical date, nearly every newspaper in Fleet Street had applied for places among the 4 frigates, which would be the guard dogs for the British trawlers in their traditional fishing grounds off Iceland. The claim to the new extended fishery limits was to be operative from the 1st of September. A few days before that, those reporters who had booked for the trip met for an Admiralty briefing. The plan, we were told, was that on the advice of the trawler skippers themselves, 3 20-mile sections of coastline would be chosen as havens. In each, a frigate would be on hand to challenge any Icelandic gunboat attempting to arrest a trawler in the disputed 4 to 12 mile band. The senior ship, HMS Eastbourne, was to have a roving commission between the havens, which were codenamed Spearmint, Butterscotch and Toffee Apple. As usual, the Foreign Office had put a damper on the proceedings. They were, they said, endeavouring to reach a diplomatic settlement, and that even an indication that reporters would be there to watch the fun on Extension Day might be regarded as prejudicial sword rattling. So no stories could be radioed from the ships till midnight on the Sunday, the 31st of August. This was plainly impracticable. Even if the Navy cope with the copy with lightning speed, and they don't usually, stories would miss all but the later editions. There were many protests, and finally it was agreed that we should cheat a little. We would write our stories on the basis of the briefing and leave them with the Admiralty Press section for release to our own offices whenever the Foreign Office was ready to admit themselves defeated. In fact, on the Sunday afternoon, the stories were released in ample time for all editions. Mine was datelined HMS Eastbourne off Iceland Sunday night and began, "British trawlers are tonight gathering in protective groups in Iceland's disputed fishing grounds. From the bridge of this British frigate I can see all around the lights of the trawlers coming in to the protection of the Royal Navy." Well, it wasn't a bad guess, except that when Sunday night came there was so much thick fog that there wasn't a trawler in sight, except on the radar screen. On the second morning, I was at breakfast in the wardroom when I felt the ship suddenly come to life from its desultory patrol speed, and over the tannoy came the warning, "Armed boarding party will be required shortly." I wondered how long it was since that announcement had been made in a British ship in peacetime. 18 miles away, the Thor, T-H-O-R, Iceland's biggest and fastest gunboat, had stopped and boarded the British trawler Northern Foam. The trawler skipper had locked himself in the wheelhouse and was defying an order to steam into the nearest Icelandic port. Now, the senior officer of the Fishery Protection Squad was Commodore Barry Anderson, a burly red-faced Scot, flying his pennant in HMS Eastbourne. And the whole way in which tempers were kept throughout this long protected dispute, it goes basically to the credit of Commodore Barry Anderson. As soon as the policy decision had been taken that the Royal Navy would resist the extension of Iceland's fishery limits, he took his ship on a courtesy visit to Reykjavik to weigh up the opposition and get onto Christian name terms with the Icelandic gunboat captains. So when we emerged from the fog and found the Northern Foam and the Thor lying some 100 yards apart, Barry Anderson picked up the loudhailer microphone. I can still see him with his white and blue knitted hat that he always wore on these occasions. He never kept to his formal naval captain's cap. Addressing himself to Captain Eric Christofferson of the Thor, and he boomed, "Christ! Chris, this is bloody daft. I'm coming over to talk to you." Thereupon he went by launch to the Thor, argued the matter over 3 cups of coffee, and with an exchange of salute, returned to the Eastbourne. Meanwhile, an armed party was dispatched to the trawler. The Icelander's own boat had already returned to the Thor, The boarders were under orders to take the northern foam into port. That is to say, the Icelandic boarders were under orders to take it into port. They were also, obviously, under orders not to resist to force. They made no effort to prevent the British sailors climbing onto the trawler, but they also declined an invitation to get into the British launch. So a second party was sent over from the Eastbourne, and then the outnumbered Icelanders were shepherded into the British port. As soon as he headed for the Thor, Captain Christofferson picked up the loudhailer and told Commodore Anderson, "You've acted unlawfully in removing my men when they'd made a lawful arrest inside Iceland's fishing limits." And thereupon the Thor steamed away. There was only one thing left for Commodore Anderson to do in order, and that was to order the Icelanders to be brought aboard the Eastbourne. There were two officers and seven ratings, and they were told that they were welcome guests in the Eastbourne until their captain chose to take them back. The officers were made members of the wardroom, and the ratings were given their own mess table with the British sailors. Next morning, the Thor came up, and the captain asked by loudhailer, "May we speak to your prisoners?" Barry Anderson took the microphone and said, "We have no prisoners. Would you like to speak to some of our Icelandic guests?" After a pause, Captain Christofferson said, "May we speak to our men?" "Certainly," said Commodore Anderson. The Icelandic captain spoke over the radio telephone with one of his officers and then steamed away again. After a few days patrolling Butterscotch Haven, Commodore Anderson decided to visit HMS Russell, the frigate shepherding the Spearmint group. The weather was too rough for boat work, so he went over to by what the Royal Navy calls a jackstay, but the Americans term the high wire. A line fixed from one ship to the other as they steam along together. On one ship it's secured to a high point, on the other it passes over a pulley and down to a tug-of-war team of sailors whose task it is to keep it taut as the ships roll towards each other or apart. Along this line a hook is hauled back and forth by a second line, and from the hook, with his foot in the stirrup and clinging affectionately to the wire supporting the stirrup, is suspended the transfer passenger. Commodore Anderson went over to talk to the Russell captain. John Chadwick of Reuters and I followed to meet our rival Stanley Bonnet of the Daily Mail and Chanter of the Daily Telegraph and the news chronicle man whose name I cannot now remember. The three journalists were running a daily ship's newspaper called the Russell Review, or Frying Tonight. Of course, Commodore Anderson challenged John Chadwick and I to produce one for HMS Eastbourne. Times photographer Charles Treslove and cine cameraman Cave Chen gave us a hand. We called it Pierhead Jump or the East